Hello, it's Wednesday the 28th of July and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. South Korea has recorded another record-high daily COVID-19 count of almost 1,900 new cases. Authorities have warned that they might consider even stronger quarantine measures if the numbers not fall. We'll have more in our news briefing. And then we'll have a roundup of the latest from the Tokyo Olympics in our Going for Gold segment. For in-depth analysis, we'll be discussing the K-pop phenom BTS's latest feat, topping the Billboard Hot 100 once again, and what that means for K-pop's place on US radio. Plus, on Korea Book Club, we'll be talking about another sci-fi thriller to hit shelves by a mysterious secret author. Let's begin Korea 24. The number of daily COVID-19 infections hit another all-time high in South Korea, with the number of local infections surpassing 1,800 for the first time since the start of the epidemic. Here to give us the latest on South Korea's ongoing battle to contain its fourth wave, as well as other headlines of the day, we have with us in the studio KBS World Radio news editor Koo Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Jang-woo.
So South Korea reported a fresh record in daily infections on Wednesday, less than a week after its previous high. This prompted top government officials to assure the public that vaccinations will proceed as planned, despite reports of a hiccup in delivery schedules. First of all, though, can you break down the latest figures for us?
Of course. The Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency on Tuesday reported 1,896 additional cases, up by 54 from its previous high of July 22nd. This brings the nation's cumulative total to 193,427. Of the new cases, 1,823 were local transmissions and 73 were from overseas. And as you said, it marks the first time local cases topped 1,800. And the ratio of infections in the Seoul metro area accounted for 66.5% of local infections, while that of non-capital areas stood at 33.5%, with 611 patients, surpassing 600 for the first time in the fourth wave. Health officials said they may adopt even tougher measures if current restrictions prove ineffective in containing the spread of the virus. The record figure also prompted Prime Minister Kim Buk-yeom to reassure the public that vaccinations will proceed as planned, allaying concerns about a possible delay in vaccine shipments. Kim said the government held a high-level video conference with Moderna overnight to discuss the supply issue and that shipments will start up again next week. Moreover, 2,679,000 doses of Pfizer vaccine arrived on Wednesday as scheduled. The government plans to unveil on Friday inoculation schedules for the remaining 22 million people between the ages of 18 and 49, about half of the nation's population above the age of 18 who can receive shots under the government's mass inoculation scheme.
Let's turn now to the latest in inter-Korean relations. The presidential office issued a denial for a second day, refuting reports that Seoul and Pyongyang are discussing the possibility of a summit between President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Now, we covered this on our Tuesday news briefing and our in-depth. What prompted this latest denial, Hee-jin?
Well, Reuters published an exclusive report out of Seoul on Wednesday, saying the two Koreas are in talks to hold a summit between their leaders, citing multiple unidentified sources within and close to the Blue House, prompting the presidential office to immediately issue a denial, its second in 2 days, regarding the issue. The report cited the sources saying they have yet to peg down a time frame or other details due to North Korea's strict border lockdown amid a global pandemic. Now, as our readers are well aware, the two sides reopened hotlines on Tuesday after the North cut off lines of communications 13 months ago, which has sparked hopes that North Korea will return to the table to re-engage in inter-Korean dialogue as well as the denuclearization of the peninsula. Park Soo-hyun, the president's senior secretary for public communication, said earlier on a local radio program on Wednesday that the government is ready to pave the way towards the ultimate goal, which is the denuclearization of the peninsula, and that a South-North summit may serve as one of its stepping stones. There was, however, an emphasis that there was no ongoing discussion between Seoul and Pyongyang as yet about a possible summit.
And it's worth noting that Kim Jong-un refrained from mentioning North Korea's so-called nuclear deterrence during a speech he delivered on Tuesday, in contrast to remarks from a year ago.
Indeed. The North's state-run Korean Central News Agency said Wednesday that Kim attended the 7th National Conference of War Veterans in Pyongyang as the nation marked its 68th anniversary of the victory in the Great Fatherland Liberation War, which, of course, refers to the signing of the Korean Armistice Agreement that ended the civil conflict better known as the Korean War. Kim said in his speech that the North's revolutionary forces are fully prepared to respond to any state of affairs or threats. However, Kim did not flaunt his nation's nuclear capabilities, in clear contrast from last year when he claimed that its nuclear weapons will forever guarantee the nation's safety and future. It was only a year ago that Kim said North Korea developed nuclear weapons to absolute strength to stave off another armed conflict, and that North Korea is now capable of defending itself in the face of any form of pressure or military threat from imperialist and hostile forces.
Yes, we'll certainly keep our listeners up to date on any further developments regarding inter-Korean relations. Meanwhile, turning to South Korea's ever-declining birth rate, the government announced that its population shrank for the 19th consecutive month. Can you tell us more?
Yes, according to the Statistics Korea on Wednesday, 22,052 babies were born in the month of May, marking a 3.5% drop and the lowest May tally since the agency began compiling related data back in 1981. The number of deaths for the month came to 25,571, up 5% on year. As a result, the nation's population decreased by more than 3,500, marking a continuous monthly decline since November 2019. The number of marriages in May also fell 11% on year to just over 16,000, another record low for the month. Divorces dropped to 5.4% to some 8,400 during the same period.
As for Korea's economy, the International Monetary Fund sharply raised its growth outlook for the country, citing its rapid recovery boosted by strong exports. Can you give us the details?
Yes. In its latest report, the IMF forecasts South Korea's economy to grow 4.3% this year, up 0.7 percentage points from its April estimate of 3.6%. The hike is larger than an average increase of 0.5 percentage points for advanced nations. The IMF also raised the country's 2022 outlook to 3.4%, up 0.6 percentage points from its April projection. The agency also maintained its growth outlook for the global economy for this year at 6%, while raising its estimate for next year by half a percentage point to 4.9%.
And that's where we'll leave it for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
We continue on now to our daily Olympics update, Going for Gold. Here we bring you the latest from Team Korea at the Tokyo 2020 Summer Olympics. And helping us do that is our staff editor, Mark Wilson-Chair, who has joined us now in the studio. Mark, hello. Hope you're doing well.
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking.
Okay, so Mark, we talked on Going for Gold yesterday about how South Korea was guaranteed to get medals. But at the time we went to air, we were still waiting to see what colour they would be.
That's right.
And sadly, Team Korea didn't grab any golds, but the matches themselves were of gold medal quality, weren't they?
Absolutely. The women's Team Epee event was thrilling. It was just back and forth. It was a battle between Team Korea and Team Estonia. We were desperate to get points in the very last relay as Choi In-jung, she was practically sprinting across the piste. It was very intense. Mm. In the end, Team Korea won its first silver medal of the Games. Credit needs to go to the Estonian team, as this is their only second medal in Tokyo so far after a bronze. And the last time the country won any gold was back in the 2008 Beijing Games, and that was in men's discus, so congratulations.
But yes, this time in the fencing, it was agonizingly close, but a great performance by Estonia. And it was still great to see the Korean women team pick up the silver, especially after falling short in the individual events this year.
Yeah.
We'll see how the saber and foil teams fare. Meanwhile, the men's saber team today have followed suit and got another gold medal match coming up, Mark.
Yeah, that's right. We talked about the 37-year-old Kim Jong-won grabbing his third consecutive medal. I love watching him. So exciting. on Monday when he slashed his way to bronze. Well, he, along with Gu Bong-gil, Oh Sang-uk, and Kim Jun-ho, they will begin their battle for gold against Italy shortly.
So another medal in the bag for Team Korea, but here's hoping that they can go one further.
Sure.
Meanwhile, last night there were two other medals won in the last of the Taekwondo events. Now, when we spoke yesterday, Mark, we knew Lee Da-bin had secured a medal as she was fighting for gold in the women's over 67-kilo match. But it's great to hear that In Kyo-don also ended up winning bronze in the men's over 80-kilo kilo category.
That's right. It was a tense battle throughout the match as In took on... he had to really bring up his defense as his Slovene opponent, Ivan Konran Trajkovic. He just threw a flurry of kicks at the very end. In ended up taking the match 5-4. Now, some of our listeners may not know that this match comes about 2 years after In beat lymphoma. He said that he hopes that his performance can inspire others who have battled cancer. So, incredible.
Yes, an incredible story to match his incredible performance. Now, as we said, of the women's over 67-kilo group, Lee Da-bin was going for gold. She wasn't able to capture it, but it was another incredible battle, Mark.
Another hard-fought one against Milica Mandic of Serbia. He had to play catch-up as she was behind for most of the match, but managed to tie things up in the final period. Mandic, however, landed several points in succession in the final seconds of the match. He took the 10-7 defeat gracefully as she was genuinely happy for her opponent. This was Serbia's first gold of the games, but it's in fact the second gold for Mandic. Mm. Oh, by the way, Lee Da-bin was apparently playing with a busted wheel. She had an ankle surgery in January and only returned to training in July. Yes, this July, this month. So that's, again, incredible.
Yes, another story of a great comeback. Lee Da-bin with the silver medal. So with that, the Taekwondo events are over, and South Korea, the home of Taekwondo, will return without a gold medal. This is, in fact, the first time Korea has been shut out of gold medals since it was added to the Olympics in 2000, Mark.
That is correct, but Jung-ho, I want to talk about this. Article after article, understandably, talk about how South Korea, the birthplace of Taekwondo, as you said, didn't grab gold. Is it considered a loss? Maybe, but I, along with many others, and you too, we would argue that it is a complete win for the sport and South Korea. Let's not forget the fact that the International Olympic Committee has mulled about removing the event completely. But through Taekwondo, some countries, like Afghanistan, have won their only Olympic medals with Taekwondo. Panipak Wumpa Tanakit of Thailand, who utterly dominated the under 49 kilogram division, she's going to be returning home a national hero in Taekwondo. So we should maybe consider that, yes, we're not returning home with the gold, but a new Taekwondo academy is going to open up abroad because of these games, and another young girl, maybe in Thailand or Serbia or wherever, they're going to watch the events, and they're going to say, you know what, I want to be that. I want to learn Taekwondo.
Right.
So that's incredible.
The diversity in Taekwondo is incredible, and it's fantastic to see how far-reached the martial art has now.
Yeah.
I still would have liked to have seen Team Korea win one gold, maybe,
sure.
And that's just being me selfish. No, I'm kidding, of course. Korea still has one silver and two bronze medals in Taekwondo, and that is still cause for pride and celebration, of course.
Absolutely.
Let's quickly talk about another sport from last night, one that happened after many of us went to bed, Mark.
Well, most of us. I was out late walking the dogs last night, past midnight, and I heard people screaming from their apartments, and I had to check my phone. I was like, oh my goodness, that's right. That's because the women's volleyball team secured a win over Kenya. Mm. So technically, this was the very first sport event result this morning. So if you check the website, it's like, boop, like right up top, first thing in the morning, team win for Team Korea. The women face off against the Dominican Republic on Thursday.
Okay, so they've recorded one win and one loss so far. Now, we have to talk about one more name before we go, and that's the one we've mentioned quite a bit already, and that's the team swimming sensation, Hwang Sun-woo.
That is correct. The 18-year-old advanced to the finals of the men's 100-meter freestyle, and while setting new milestones along the way. First, he is the first-ever South Korean to ever make it to the finals of the 100-meter freestyle event, who, by the way, was the only Asian in the semifinals held earlier in the day. Now, I know what a lot of listeners are thinking. I thought so, too. And the answer is no. Legendary Korean swimmer Park Tae-hwan has his four Olympic medals in either the 200 or the 400-meter freestyle event. So he and Hwang overlap in the 200-meter freestyle. So now people can start seeing the difference between the two swimmers. With Hwang's time of 47.56 seconds, that's not only a new national record, but it is also a new world junior record and a new Asian record. He's not out of the woods yet, as he finished third in his heat. Perhaps he is conserving energy. Let's see. Hwang Sung-woo swims for gold tomorrow at 11:37 a.m.
Yes, I'm so curious about how he does. I know it might be a stretch, but we saw how he fell short in the 200 meters, of course. But he keeps raising our expectations like this.
Yeah.
And I'll definitely be glued to my TV screen tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm. Just to finish up, Mark, what other events should we look out for tomorrow, Thursday?
Mm-hmm. Well, like clockwork, more judo gold is up for grabs. Remember, we have an athlete in every weight class, so whenever there's a judo gold, we're vying for it. Another round of archery eliminations. We'll see women's archery star An San fighting to make it to Friday when the women's medal event will be held. And men's golf will tee off tomorrow, and the baseball team will take on Israel.
Well, that's all for Going for Gold today. Thank you for that roundup, Mark, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
Talk to you then.
The K-pop boy band BTS did it again. The septet topped Billboard's Hot 100 chart for a ninth consecutive week, this time with their previous number one track, Butter, returning to the top spot and replacing their newer song, Permission to Dance, which slipped to seventh. BTS has become the only act to displace itself at number one with a new song and then send their previous number one song back to the summit with no other acts holding the top spot in between. To help us dissect the latest feat by the K-pop phenom, as well as look at BTS's success in the context of the wider K-pop industry in general, we're joined on the line by Bernie Cho, president of the Korean Music Artist and Label Services Agency, DFSB Collective. Bernie, welcome back on the show.
It's good to be back.
So BTS have topped the chart again, replacing itself with its previous number one single. That is quite the achievement, isn't it? Just a couple of years ago, we perhaps never could have thought that there'd be a K-pop artist topping the chart, but now we have this artist, BTS, topping it multiple times. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, I mean, for a lot of industry people, just wrapping their heads around the massive success of Butter was still something that was just absolutely stunning. I mean, we have to just take a step back and realize that just Butter not only going number one, but it shattered YouTube records for the biggest debut ever in one day with 108.2 billion views in one day, breaking its previous record with Dynamite. And on Spotify, it had not only the biggest first debut in history with 11 million streams, but the biggest first week debut in history with 99.4 million streams. And it was the fastest song in history to surpass 100 million streams. And so, you know, they not only hit number one, but they hit number one with a huge exclamation point. And so, you know, obviously that in and of itself was huge. But the fact that week after week after week, it stayed at number one. And they started, you know, moving from idol to really icon territory. Because when you're, you know, staying on top of the Billboard 100 for that long, I mean, you're in very high echelon company with artists such as the Beatles or Taylor Swift, Drake, The Weeknd, and now we can say fellow management company mates, Justin Bieber. Now, right now, you know, obviously a lot of people are placing bets that their next single could possibly maybe replace Butter at number one, and lo and behold, it did. And then, you know, just as people were trying to think what other records could they break, because, you know, BTS replacing themselves at number one has actually, you know, been done before. Again, as I mentioned, 14 times. But they actually came up with a brand new record no one was really thinking about, because they were just assuming that, well, Permission to Dance could stick around for maybe another week, 2 weeks. But having Butter resurge and go back to number one, according to Billboard, it's the first time a song was replaced by another song from the same artist and then was replaced again by the previous song. So, you know, if these guys are looking to break more Guinness Book of World Records, I think BTS should start breaking open more cans of Guinness beers to celebrate.
There's perhaps no one answer to this, and I'm sure many have tried, and I think we've talked to you about it as well. But what do you think has been the secret to BTS's success?
Well, I think obviously BTS, you know, have really made a concerted effort to go more mainstream in the U.S. And obviously having their new hit singles being sung entirely in English has obviously pushed them to that, you know, final frontier. And then more importantly is them just coming up with epic music videos and absolutely crushing it both in the audio and video streaming space. And I think what it's also helped is the fact that they've spent years building their image, building their reputation on not only early morning talk shows, but more importantly, late night talk shows in the U.S. Because for a lot of Americans, you know, three places that they become familiar with music acts is obviously radio, but also these early morning talk shows and especially late night talk shows. And BTS are really sort of reaping the rewards of their years of effort penetrating U.S. mainstream media outlets.
You mentioned there the importance of radio. The Billboard chart is based on online streaming, sales in the U.S. market and radio play. And it's perhaps that last aspect that has been most groundbreaking, as that was a key barrier seen for K-pop artists that they couldn't break in the U.S. mainstream before. How challenging is it for non-U.S. artists to get radio airplay in the U.S.?
Well, you know, it's one of the things is, you know, we got to think about history in the sense that, you know, when Psy had his monster hit Gangnam Style, everyone just assumed it would go number one because it, again, similar to BTS, had absolutely staggering numbers in streams and downloads and sales, both video and audio streaming. And yet it only debuted number two on the Hot 100, and everybody was wondering why. And when the explanation was given that, oh, by the way, it's not just driven by streams and by sales and by downloads, but also by radio airplay, that made a lot of people sort of scratch their heads as to, well, how much does radio count and what can we do to sort of make those numbers work in the favor of a K-pop artist? Lo and behold, BTS came along and they really, you know, took that baton further and tried to bring it over the finish line. And they were too ran into similar problems and issues in terms of obviously BTS was bringing home, you know, significant, staggering audio, video, streaming numbers, sales, downloads and whatnot. But yet radio airplay was the mystery that needed to be solved. And from what I can tell and from what I know, and more importantly, from what I've heard, the thing that BTS has done differently than other K-pop acts in the past is, number one, they teamed up with a U.S. major label, in this case, Sony Music, vis-a-vis through their label Columbia Records. And having a major label behind you definitely gets you more access, more exposure to U.S. radio, because in order to get U.S. radio airplay, particularly on the top 40 radio stations, it's very difficult for an international artist, but more importantly, it's extremely difficult, and I would say almost borderline impossible if you're an independent artist. And on paper, BTS is both international and independent. And so having Sony behind them, I think, definitely helps. And more importantly, you know, Sony guiding them in terms of what it takes to break the U.S. market, I think, has helped tremendously. And then the one thing that BTS has done well that some other K-pop acts, such as Blackpink, are also doing extremely well, is the members are more comfortable speaking in English, whether it's one member or a few members. That goes a long way in terms of shattering stereotypes and making people more comfortable, particularly not just audiences and fans, but more importantly, radio station producers and programmers, so that it's compelling to invite K-pop artists who right now are essentially pop artists, and you treat them as such. And English, being comfortable in doing interviews, definitely is a necessity. And BTS and Blackpink are both doing it well. But the other thing too is that you know, a lot of people in, especially outside of America, don't know how the U.S. radio system works. They just assume that it's purely, strictly based on popularity. And that's totally not the case. It's probably a little bit more of an art than a science, but there are definitely elements of the U.S. radio system, station system, that a lot of fans are confused by, because they just assume, well, if you call in enough times, that should be enough to push the song to number one and rate airplay. And for better or for worse, U.S. radio, and frankly, for that matter, many other major music markets, that's often not the case. There's a lot more to it.
Okay, so should we call it perhaps a lobbying power that BTS have done well? But how high is that English language barrier as well, though, for radio airplay? Because even with BTS, three of their four number one songs have been in English, including Dynamite, Butter and Permission to Dance. Their only non-English song, Life Goes On, did reach number one, but I understand they had very little radio airplay. And there was also this very interesting article recently by Vox titled Why Won't American Radio Play More K-Pop? And it pointed to how radio play of K-Pop in the US is nearly non-existent still, even with BTS paving the way.
Yeah, I read that article too. And, you know, although I'm a big fan of Vox and I understand what the reporter was trying to get at, unfortunately, I think the reporter didn't really have a clear, complete, comprehensive grasp as to how U.S. radio works. Number one, this particular reporter was trying to write this during the height of COVID, which immediately excludes a lot of marketing and promotion activities for Korean music acts because they can't travel to the U.S. to market and promote their songs in person. So I think that was one huge sort of misstep. The other thing too is that a lot of these big radio stations, they often use focus group testing in order to determine what new songs and what new songs should be added and what old songs should be dropped. And the reality is that when a lot of these radio stations are doing focus group testing, K-pop songs are often not in those focus group samples because many K-pop acts are currently not being distributed or you know, managed or administered by major U.S. record labels such as Universal Music, Warner Music, and Sony Music. There is a reason why BTS and Blackpink are very much, you know, high-powered, high-profile K-pop acts, you know, very much succeeding in the pop music spaces because both of those particular acts are currently working with, specific to the U.S., major labels. In Blackpink's case, they're working with Universal Music and Interscope. And again, as I mentioned before, BTS is working with Sony and Columbia. And I think that says a lot about the power and the influence of major labels pushing K-pop into becoming essentially the new pop in the U.S. market. When people talk about other Korean music acts that they think should be deserving of radio airplay in the U.S., you have to lift the cover and look under the lid to sort of see who behind the scenes has the ability to push that song. And right now, a lot of Korean music acts don't have that U.S. major label push behind them to make U.S. radio airplay more and more the rule, and rather than what's currently now the exception.
Then do you see signs that more labels in the Korea, K-pop labels, are catching on to this now, and perhaps we might see a turning point where there might be more radio play in the U.S., especially Korean language songs as well?
Well, I definitely think that, you know, again, when we look at the 2020 numbers, recently the IFPI, which is stands for the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, that's a mouthful, but they essentially represent the global music industry. A few weeks ago, they just recently came out with their year in review for 2020. And it turns out that Korea was the fastest growing music market in the world with 44% year-on-year growth, which is absolutely unheard of given what's going on with COVID. But more importantly was Korea tied the UK as the second largest music exporter. The fact that K-pop acts were neck and neck with UK acts in terms of global appeal, global sales, speaks volumes. And when you look at who the best-selling artists were in the world and the best-selling albums in the world, 2020 was dominated by K-pop globally. BTS was the best-selling artist in the world with not just the number one, but the number two best-selling albums in the world. And Blackpink was the best-selling female band in the world, and they constantly popped up among, you know, charts for top 10 or top 20 songs that charted and streamed and sold around the world. And so for a lot of U.S. music industry people, be it record labels, talent agencies, or concert promoters, they know now that, again, as I said before, K-pop has emerged as a new pop music. And so there is a lot of interest, a lot of intrigue, and a lot of curiosity as to who could be that next BTS or who could be that next Blackpink. And again, the local market is incredibly vibrant, but more importantly, the export market for K-pop. K-pop is now the best-selling Asian music genre in the world, and it turns out it's now the second most popular international music in the world as of 2020.
Well, it looks like K-pop will continue to knock on the door, and it'll be a matter of when, not if, the U.S. will get on board and see more radio K-pop airplay in the future. We'll leave it there. We've been speaking to Bernie Cho from DFSB Collective. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 4.33 points, or 0.13% on Wednesday, closing the day at 3,236.86. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ fell, however, losing 10.87 points, or 1.04%, to close at 1,035.68. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 4.51 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,154.61. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We turn now to our daily segment, Korea Trending. For this part of the show, we check out some of the other news stories that have been trending online here in Korea today. And for that, we have Walter Lee joining us on the line today. Walter, hello.
Hello, Jenna. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Hope you're doing well as well. So what topics do you have for us today?
Okay, so our first story is about a new identity verification service that the government is set to launch from early next year. We'll then talk about an alleged sexual assault case that occurred in the subway over the weekend. And our last story is about U.S. gymnast Simone Biles, who pulled out of the Olympic women's team final in Tokyo.
OK, let's get started on our first story then. And it's about a very interesting new ID verification system that's set to be introduced. Can you tell us more, Walter?
That's correct. So starting from early next year, South Koreans will be able to verify their identity via their smartphones without having to carry around their physical identification card. The Ministry of the Interior and Safety announced today that it is pushing to implement this mobile verification service from the end of January next year. Once implemented, the service can help verify and authenticate one's personal information like name, resident registration number, and address just with their smartphones.
I see. So that means no need to carry around a card anymore, potentially. And so that is set to be more convenient for people then, I guess.
Yes. Well, for many instances, yes. It can be used in various situations like when verifying one's age at convenience stores and restaurants, when identification is required when boarding airplanes or ships, and when registering a civil document or issuing certificates. However, if there's a regulation in a statute that requires the presentation of physical identification cards, then identification through mobile verification services would be restricted.
However, I'm sure many listening are already asking, is it secure? Has the government addressed concerns on safety?
Well, in that regard, the ministry said that there is no concern of personal information being leaked, even if you were to lose your smartphone, as the information cannot be stored on the phone itself. That's because you will be receiving a QR code instead that carries your personal information.
Yes, I think there will likely need to be more assurances about safety and security before the service is launched. But if successful, it could really change everyday life here in Korea. It's certainly an intriguing prospect. Let's move on to our second story now. What do you have for us?
Okay, so our next story is about an alleged sexual assault to a woman in her 20s that happened over the weekend. The victim told local media today that a man in his 50s approached her when she was seated on a subway Line 1 train at 7 a.m. Sunday morning. There was no one on the train at that time. When she tried to escape to the next car, she was caught and shoved into the seats and then was threatened with a weapon held to her neck. The man reportedly told her to stay still and that he's doing this because he thought she was very pretty. When she tried to resist, he further assaulted her by hitting her multiple times.
That is a truly terrifying situation. I understand, though, that she was able to make it off the train at some point.
Yes, well, according to her, after she fled the train, she ran around the station pleading for help, but no one came to her aid nor asked her what was wrong. She said that she couldn't believe something like this could happen in South Korea in 2021.
I see. Very unfortunate. So what happened to the man who attacked her? Was he eventually caught then?
Well, yes, he was some 11 hours after the incident. The police organized 20 people to track his movements and eventually succeeded in arresting him. Currently, the police are conducting an investigation into his motives and other additional crimes he may have committed. The Korea Railroad Corporation, or KORAIL, had planned to install CCTV cameras on all trains within 3 years. However, of the subway lines 1, 3 and 4, managed by KORAIL, less than 10% have such cameras installed to date.
So the call for more cameras on trains will likely grow after this incident, but indeed the man does sound like a very disturbed individual, unfortunately. Let's move on to our last story now. And once again, it's related to the Olympics. Can you tell us more, Walter?
Right. So Simone Biles, the 24-year-old US gymnast who is widely referred to as the GOAT, or the greatest of all time, pulled out of the Olympic women's team final in Tokyo yesterday, which was shocking to many Olympic viewers. She was widely expected to lead the US team to another Olympic gold in the team event. However, after scoring 13.766, her lowest Olympic vault score, she left the arena. But she soon returned to support her teammates as they took silver behind the Russian Olympic Committee. While Biles has said that she will decide whether to continue competing in Tokyo, an email statement from the USA Gymnastics on Wednesday revealed that she will not compete in the individual all-round finals, which is scheduled for tomorrow. The email further read that Biles will be evaluated daily to determine whether she will participate in next week's event finals.
Yes, many will remember her storming the gym at the 2016 Summer Games in Rio, topping the leaderboard in almost every event she entered and winning 5 medals, 4 gold and 1 bronze. She, in fact, has a combined total of 30 Olympic and World Championship titles. So this sudden decision to pull out was a shock, as you said. Do we know the reason for her withdrawal?
Well, long story short, her withdrawal was due to her concerns over her own mental health. She acknowledged the immense pressure that she's been facing and that part of the reason for pulling out was her concern that she might, quote, do something silly and hurt herself during the competition. She had also taken to social media previously to comment that the Olympics is, quote, no joke, and that although she makes it seem like the pressure doesn't affect her, she truly does feel like she has the weight of the world on her shoulders.
I see. One cannot help but feel sympathy for her situation. What has been the response like so far?
Well, messages of support poured in from not only other athletes, but figures outside the sports community as well. Former Olympic champion and retired gymnast Ali Raisman said that the Olympic athletes are human and they're doing the best they can and commended Biles for her bravery. Sarah Hirschland, the chief executive of the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, also commended Biles for prioritizing mental wellness and said that the Team USA committee will offer her full support and resources as she goes forward. Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, also took to social media to thank and support Biles and that she is still, quote, the GOAT.
Sure, we sometimes expect our sporting stars to be superhuman almost, but that expectation can be unfair at times. And before anything else, it's important for the athletes to look after themselves and their well-being, whether it be physical or mental, and we wish her the best. And that's all the time we have for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for those stories, Walter, and we'll talk to you again next time.
See you on Friday.
It's time now for our special monthly edition of Korea Book Club. Usually here on the club, we discuss Korean books that are available in translation or English language works about Korea, but once a month, we take a look at a current bestseller or popular book in Korea that has not yet been translated, so we get a better sense of the literary scene currently. And we do that with literary translator Anton He, who joins us on the line now. Anton, it's great to speak to you again.
Hi, Jang-ho. Hope you're well.
I'm good, thank you. Hope you're well, too. So what book do you have for us today?
This week's book is Counterweight, or Pyeongheongchu, by the author Duna. Duna is a mononym. And the book is published by Alma.
Okay, so it's another sci-fi book. We have covered quite a few over the last year or so, and this is further evidence of that trend we've been seeing, I guess, Counterweight. I think that sounds like a very interesting, intriguing title. What does it mean, and how does it relate to what's in the book?
The title of this book comes from the central metaphor of the novel, which is a space elevator that stretches from a fictional island in the South Seas called Patusan all the way into Earth's orbit. The space elevator is held up on the other end by the centrifugal force of a counterweight, which is a large mass of space garbage that is agglomerated into a heavy mass. The idea of a space elevator is by no means new, but Duna situates it in a colonial or neo-colonial narrative in which transnational corporate or capitalist interests conflict with those of indigenous interests. The space elevator is being built by a Korean chaebol company called LK, and this corporation will use any means necessary to finish the space elevator and become a competitor in the space race. The novel is narrated by an almost faceless LK functionary named Mac, who is used to all the conspiracies that surround his employer and has a hand in creating some of them himself, but he soon realizes that there are certain conspiracies that he, too, had been unaware of this whole time. It's a very fast-paced thriller with some truly spectacular action sequences and really interesting fictional technology. It's very much bringing to mind Michael Crichton's old tech thrillers like Jurassic Park or Sphere.
I see. That's very interesting, and it sounds quite elaborate as well. You've mentioned that colonialism is a major theme in this novel. How exactly is that explored in the work then, especially considering it's a work of science fiction and not history, and it's set in a fictional country at that?
In literature, colonialism or neocolonialism in this case is understood as the intervention of an outside force into indigenous matters. And the author draws clear lines of connection between old and modern ideas of colonialism, highlighting both what they have in common and what differences exist. For example, the island nation in question is called Patusan, which is, of course, the name of the island nation in Lord Jim by Joseph Conrad, who also wrote Heart of Darkness, a novel set in the Belgian Congo. At one point in the novel, a Patusan character accuses LK of acting like 19th century colonists, despite it being an age where we are obviously building space elevators and sending people into space. The space elevator itself is, of course, a symbol of colonialism, because the point of going to space in this novel and in many narratives is to colonize it and reap the resources and expand our reach. The development of the space elevator is, of course, dressed up as romantic scientific progress. But we know that in the 19th century as well, colonization was dressed up as bringing quote-unquote civilization to the quote-unquote savages and explorers who are exploring the world. And South Korea is at a really interesting stage in its economic development where we used to be colonized and exploited, but now we're sending our companies overseas and scouting for resources and recruiting workers to create our products. So Duna's novel not only touches upon this recent development here in Korea, but they also draw implications on the space race and the future of colonization. And it's also very interesting to note that recent space exploration exploits were by people like Jeff Bezos or Richard Branson. And these are all private entrepreneurs, and one does wonder about the selflessness of their motivations.
Right, like a lot of the best science fiction works, it's not just about an imagined a future world, but it says something about the world we live in today. So it seems like this work is working on many levels as well. Now, you mentioned that this book is an action-packed one. Namely, there's a very elaborate car chase involving a moving laboratory and motorcycles, as well as the climax of the novel, where, without giving away too much, the protagonists make their way up the space elevator. It almost reads like a movie. Do you think this was a stylistic choice, perhaps, on the part of the author?
You're right, and I think it absolutely was. Apparently, this novel began as a screenplay for what was supposed to be a low-budget science fiction film, but there are limits as to how low-budget one can make a space elevator, even with today's fancy movie technology. And so Duna adapted their idea into a popular short story and then expanded it into this novel. And the pacing and the variety of action sequences are very cinematic, which attests to the DNA of the novel, so to speak. And this is why I mentioned Michael Crichton earlier, because this is quite similar to his style as well, where he was, of course, the movie director himself, now most famously for Westworld, which has been remade into a very successful HBO series. And I would love to see this book as a movie or a Netflix adaptation. I think it would lend itself extremely well to that sort of treatment.
Indeed. Let's talk about the author a bit as well, Duna. You said it's a mononym, but that's pretty much all we know about him or her or they at this point, right? Because their identity is kept a secret. But Duna is known as one of Korea's most popular and prolific film critics and writers of speculative fiction. But what more can you tell us beyond that?
There's very little I can tell you about Duna. First of all, you're very correct in using the pronoun they, because frankly, we have no idea what gender Duna identifies as or presents as. No one knows what they look like. No one knows where they grew up or went to school. We don't even know if Duna is a human being. In a blurb, Sarah Chong said that she wished Duna's brain could be made into an AI so Duna can keep on writing novels forever. But how do you know if Duna already isn't an AI? So all we know about Duna is that they first became popular during the 90s when we were using services like Cholian to use the internet, like CompuServe and America Online in the U.S. And Duna eventually branched out to having their own website and began publishing books, and they're currently corporeally represented by a rabbit photograph in their Twitter avatar. They are also the president of the Korean Science Fiction Writers Alliance, and for the press release, they took a photo of a stuffed rabbit instead of Duna themselves. But frankly, for all we know, that stuffed rabbit is Duna.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but this mysterious authorship certainly adds another intriguing dimension to this work. As I mentioned earlier, there seems to be an explosion of science fiction going on in Korea at the moment, with more titles than ever coming out and the genre doing better than ever in terms of sales. We did talk about this before, but I think it's worth reassessing again, Anton. Why do you think we are seeing this trend?
I think back then what I said was, well, we are living in science fiction now, so... I think now, if I think about it more, I think people are just really tired of reality and they want to be soothed by a dystopian vision of a world that can always be worse than the one we're living in now. I think much of science fiction is also about processing our anxiety about the future. And things are so uncertain now with the pandemic and these dang vaccines that keep getting delayed that we want to see a spectacle of controlled violence and disaster. So it's not so much the violence and disaster itself that people are interested in, but the sense of control by the author in portraying and containing that violence and making things come out all right in the end. And I think that's the kind of control we've been craving for the past couple of years, in which we've been basically living in a state of freefall. That's just my theory.
I see. Well, finally, very briefly, you mentioned you would like to see this work as a possibly Netflix series or a film. We are starting to see these sorts of science fiction works coming from Korea, getting picked up for more translation as well. Do you think this works as another potential work for a wider global readership?
I think it is absolutely ripe for translation. And my fingers are crossed that it will be picked up. There is a sample available, and I think it is being marketed as we speak.
Well, once again, this book is called Pyeongyang Chu, which we have translated as Counterweight, and it is by the mysterious author Duna. Anton, thank you for introducing us to this work, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Thank you, Anna. See you soon.
And we bring our show to a close there. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so do join us again then to get your daily dose of Korean news and analysis. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-woo, and thank you for listening. Goodbye.